The Golden Knight's army has vanquished the kings.
I couldn't resist. I just had to bring back the voice of the pregame show for the Las Vegas Golden Knights.
The West belongs to Vegas.
Not only have the Knights reached the Stanley Cup Finals in their first season, they've made ice hockey a hit in the middle of the desert. But turns out the Golden Knights didn't do all that in a vacuum. Only a Game's Martin Kessler has the story about some true Las Vegas hockey pioneers.
2 years ago, when the NHL announced that Las Vegas was getting an expansion team, plenty of locals were skeptical.
There was some people that thought the casinos don't like competition.
That's Brian Bulmer, a Vegas resident of nearly 50 years. Bulmer heard others say that the team would have to rely too heavily on tourists.
That the locals couldn't fill it up.
But Bulmer was optimistic.
I knew there was people in this town that loved the game.
Bulmer didn't just have a feeling about that. He knew it. Because 5 decades ago, Brian Bulmer played for the first pro hockey team to call Las Vegas home. The team was called the Las Vegas Gamblers, and they paved the way for the Golden Knights. The story of hockey in Las Vegas really starts with an ice rink. It was called the Ice Palace, and it was built in the late 60s in a strip mall a few blocks from the Sahara Hotel and Casino.
And the rink, as I was told, was built by the Teamsters Union, or with Teamsters Union money.
If you've seen the movie Casino with Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci, you know why that's noteworthy.
These are the guys who secretly control Las Vegas.
Mama got that face again.
Because they control the Teamsters Union. And that's where you had to go if you wanted to borrow money to buy a casino.
Jimmy Hoffa, the head of the Teamsters Union in the late 50s, he was tied to organized crime. I mean, there's really no dispute about that.
This is Jeff Schumacher with the Mob Museum in Las Vegas.
They sort of came up with this scheme for the Teamsters Union pension fund to be used to hand out loans for construction of casinos and other things in Las Vegas.
We can't say for sure whether the mob had anything to do with the Teamsters loaning money to build an ice rink in the middle of the desert, but Bulmer offers this.
All I can say about that is we were told that the rink was built with money enough to have individual seating. But when it actually was built, it was just bare aluminum benches. So that money went somewhere. I don't know where, but that's just part of the history of this town.
So the Ice Palace didn't have individual seats, but it did have a bar overlooking the ice and a regulation-sized rink. And that was good enough to support the Las Vegas Gamblers. The team formed in 1968 and started playing teams from LA, Salt Lake, and other nearby cities. The Gamblers had an eclectic roster. They had school teachers and bartenders, blackjack and craps dealers. There was a guy who sold booze to the 600-plus bars in town, and eventually an FBI agent who'd come to practices when he wasn't catching bank robbers. But there were a couple of challenges for a hockey team trying to attract a crowd in Las Vegas in the late 60s. First off, there was lots of competition for people's attention.
That's when Elvis Presley was the premier performer in Las Vegas. This is the older, heavier Elvis Presley. And he was playing at the International. And then down the street, you had Liberace. Liberace was playing to huge crowds, and then you had Tom Jones. And he was selling out showrooms.
And then there was the fact that it was ice hockey in Las Vegas. Did the average people in town seem to know that much about hockey when you first showed up there?
Oh, no, they had no idea.
That's Don Woodbury, another former gambler. In 1968, Woodbury was transferred to Las Vegas for his job with Firestone Tires. He'd grown up playing junior hockey in the Ottawa Auditorium, which held 7,000 fans and was built for the sport. As for the Las Vegas Ice Palace?
This wasn't. I mean, I think hockey was an afterthought.
Woodbury says the Ice Palace only had room for a couple thousand fans. That first season, only a few hundred would show up for games. In the Gambler's Game program, there was a section called Know Your Hockey, which explained the rules. But the Gamblers did have a couple things going for them from the start. First off, with so many young transplants from Canada and the Midwest living in town, the team was drawing guys who'd grown up playing high-level youth hockey. And then there was this.
Was it hard for you guys to ever get teams to come visit and play you guys?
No, not at all.
They loved to play us.
Teams wanted to come here all the time. As soon as they found out it was available, we could pick and choose.
Teams from the Midwest and beyond started coming to Vegas to play on Friday and Saturday nights. But usually, opponents would get to town on Thursday.
We'd have a party when they arrived at the hotel. I was going to say no drinking, but you know I was lying.
Oh yeah, get them drunk.
This is Bill Brisky, the booze salesman slash defenseman on the Gamblers roster.
Get them drunk and tell them, hey, take it easy on us. We don't have, you know, a whole lot here. And by the time they woke up, they were behind 5-1.
We usually won that first game. We usually did. So I'd have to say that Brisky's a pretty smart fella.
They thought they were coming out. They were going to do some gambling and drinking, a regular junket. You know, it was a holiday for them, right? But they would get beat and they'd say, oh, God, you guys are really good.
So the Gamblers won a lot, and they started drawing bigger crowds.
And it just kind of snowballed.
Sometimes fans would watch practices. A busload would follow the team to games in Fresno or Reno. And when the Gamblers played at home, there was a tradition for the players and fans after every game.
We'd go upstairs and party with them.
Brisky says the bar above the rink would be so packed after games you could barely move. Fans would buy the players drinks and they'd talk about the game. And it wasn't just limited to the bar at the Ice Palace.
Any place we went, we'd bring fans with us.
I'm not surprised that the people loved you guys if you took them out.
Oh, we had a good time, yeah. Everybody had a good time.
But while the fans were having a good time, something else was going on.
Did you notice that over time, the crowds became more knowledgeable about the sport?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, that happened. They knew what was going on. They knew what should be going on. Icing, offside, the penalties. When they thought there was a penalty should be called, they let the refs know.
Don Woodbury still remembers one fan, a local chef, who'd catch his eye every game and give him a thumbs up or a thumbs down, depending on how he felt Woodbury had been playing. On at least one occasion, a Gamblers fan tried to fight an opposing player. So a hockey culture was developing in Las Vegas. But drawing fans wasn't the only way the Gamblers brought the sport to the city.
We taught so many kids how to skate.
We'd get a folding chair out there and let them push it around the ice.
I love the image of you guys as these, you know, high-level hockey players. In most other towns, if you guys were coaching youth players, it would probably be the cream of the crop. But here you guys are in Las Vegas, literally teaching little kids how to skate.
That's exactly it, and it was a lot of fun.
It was more like a community type then. And their parents would be in there, and that would help our thing too, you know, get the parents and the kids interested in our game.
Brian Bulmer estimates that over the years, he and his teammates taught a few hundred kids in Las Vegas how to skate. Then in the early 70s, a casino owner named Ralph Engelstead took control of the team in Vegas. Instead of the Gamblers, they became the Las Vegas Outlaws.
And Ralph had a little bit of money, so that's kind of when the hockey started to take off in caliber.
The Outlaws hosted the 1972 U.S. Olympic team, as well as top squads from Europe.
We were really starting to build something.
But like lots of attractions in Las Vegas, the hockey team was hot for a couple years, and then it was on the outs. The Outlaws folded after the 74-75 season. There are a couple of possible explanations. Brisky says the team got in trouble on an overseas trip. There may have been too much trash talk against the Russians and too many fights in Germany. Bulmer says the owner of the rink and the owner of the team couldn't come to an agreement.
The rink wasn't available to us anymore, and Ralph Engelstead actually started to build his own rink, but it never turned out, and hockey just died right there.
But even though the team stopped playing, there were still all those adults in town who'd come to love the sport, and all those kids who'd learned to skate.
I would love to think that some of those people are part of what's out there watching the Golden Knights now, and I hope we left a little bit of enjoyment that helped to build with this.
Brian Bulmer and Bill Brisky still live in Las Vegas. Don Woodbury now follows the Golden Knights from L.A. And even though he left Las Vegas decades ago, he loves talking about his time with the Gamblers.
I'm telling you, I get so excited, I can't believe it. I can't believe I'm doing this. I'm having more fun than you are. You don't know that. I'm stoked right now.
I told Don Woodbury that that was saying something, because I loved hearing about Las Vegas's true hockey pioneers. But it did make me sad to learn that some of the former gamblers hadn't made it to a Golden Knights game. Brisky told me the tickets were too expensive. I think the Golden Knights should honor you guys, should have you guys all come for a game.
You know, thank you. That would be really great. Just introduce us at one, the original Las Vegas gamblers. I still have my shirt. And we're all getting old, so if you've got anything to do with it, tell them they better hurry.
I know a guy who knows a guy. I'll give him a call. That story was produced and reported by Only a Game's Martin Kessler. From the age of 12, surfer Joey Baran wanted to win the Pipeline Masters. At the age of 24, he finally did, but it wasn't the triumph he was expecting.
I literally was standing on the beach in pouring rain with my three surfboards by myself, and the thought was so clear and so profound in my mind, this is it? There's got to be more than this.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.